Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. We use the internet for just about everything these days, including gambling. Do you gamble online? Only 3 states allow online gaming right now. Some tribes are working to get into the online gambling game, but state and federal laws may be in the way. Would you like to see your tribe get into iGaming? Do you see any dangers with it? Could online gaming be profitable for tribes? Or will it pull away from the traditional brick-and-mortar tribal casinos? That's next, right after the news. Please join us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. There's a new push in Canada for a national investigation into the issue of missing and murdered Aboriginal girls and women. Many of the victims' families are telling their stories and saying police are not doing enough, Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The focus is on about 250 cases, some of which stretch back as far as 1951. Many of the families and loved ones of the victims share a painful bond of grief. Some are trying to heal that pain through sharing circles. M.A. Kraft is a lawyer and an Aboriginal advocate from Winnipeg. Kraft says more can and needs to be done.
So often we've looked at these women's stories, these unsolved crimes, as either a police investigation or a media story. And now I think it's a beautiful thing that we're actually looking at the stories of these individuals and digging down a little bit deeper into their lives and in a lot of cases, their unrealized potential by talking to their family members and friends and communities and knowing a little bit more about them.
Many of the families say their voices have not been heard, and without the stories, the healing process can't be complete. Kraft also says the federal government has refused to recognize the issue of murdered and missing Aboriginal women and girls across Canada as a sociological problem.
Right now, the Harper government has said, this is a question of criminality. This is not a sociological phenomenon, but a disappearance rate like we see it for Indigenous women in Canada and for any group of disappearing women necessitates an understanding and an acknowledgement that there is a sociological phenomenon that underlies this.
Kraft says what's needed is participation from the communities and the families to understand the problem. She says poverty is a huge issue that is often not acknowledged, and also the push for a national inquiry must continue. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Some Native Americans in Washington say the new fish consumption rules being proposed by the state are a step in the right direction, but may not go far enough. Steve Jackson reports.
The Department of Ecology is looking at a proposal to change the fish consumption rates in the state. If approved, the rules would result in a tightening of standards on the amount of pollution that could be released into state waterways. The new proposal dramatically increases the average fish consumption standards to 175 grams of fish per person per day. That's about the size of a fish fillet. That from the current standard of just over 6 grams of fish per day per state resident. Ecology says the standards need to be updated because of the diets of Native Americans and Asian residents. Jim Peters of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission says, as a member of the Squaxin Island tribe, the amount of fish eaten per day is actually much higher than the 175-gram figure.
It's really low compared. Like for Squaxin, which doesn't include shellfish, our fish consumption rate is around 280 to 300 grams per day. I know Suquamish's is up towards the 600 level. Some of them are right around 300, and then Spokane's, I think, got theirs at 800.
Even so, Peters says he understands how Ecology came up with the number as an average of state consumption. Peters says he does have a problem with Ecology's proposal to raise the consumption rate while at the same time changing the acceptable cancer rate from one case per million to one in 100,000 people.
Our study at Squaxin actually indicates that kids under the age of 5 eat 6 times more fish than adults do. And so our kids are going to be impacted the most because of their immune systems being built up.
An official with the Department of Ecology says their agency is not yet offering any reaction to the many comments received during that public comment period on the new fish standards that ended last month. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Supported by the Tribal Telecom and Technology Conference, Weaving Pathways Across the Digital Divide. The annual Tribal Telecom Golf Classic will be held May 4th, 2015 at the Isleta Eagle Golf Course. Info at tribaltelecomconference.com. Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American Indians 50 and over. For yourself, your family, and our community, get screened. Info at AmericanIndianCancer.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. If you've ever been to a casino, you know these sounds. Casinos are noisy and busy with activity. The lights and sounds are constantly going, and every once in a while, you hear someone shout with excitement. If you like to gamble, would you trade that experience for gambling at home? Or even on your phone or tablet? Some tribes are testing the waters. That is, playing poker, slots, and even keno on a website for real money. Online gaming could mean big profits, but is the time right? Gambling or online or iGaming has some limitations in the U.S. Only 3 states have legalized it. Can tribes get into the game without state approval? Should they be considering it? How will it affect the casino business? And where do you stand on online gaming? Our phone lines are open. The number to participate is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Temecula, California is Victor Rocha. He is the owner and editor of Pechanga.net, which has a wealth of current information on Indian gaming. And he's a member of the Pechanga Band of Luseño Indians. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Victor.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And Victor, to get us started, tell us a little bit about how online gaming is legal in the U.S. Is it completely outlawed? Why is it only legal in 3 states?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. I think like anything in the United States, if it's good, it's fun, it's either fattening or illegal or both. And online gaming, it's one of those things that just kind of took over and revolutionized the industry that just like what the internet did with everything else, just like it's changed bookstores and record stores and, had this effect on the industry. The internet has that same effect on the gaming industry. So it started in Europe and it became very, very successful. And then, it wasn't illegal. It was in this gray area. They called it the gray market. And so until 2007, I believe it was. Am I right? I'm starting to get my number. Maybe 2008. Some legislation was passed called the UGIA, which is the Unlawful Gaming Internet Regulation Act. And that kind of took the wind out of the sails of the gaming and made it so that doing a financial transaction for online gaming is illegal. So it kind of came in through the back door. It was happening and everybody was so busy watching their business, and all of a sudden it just gained popularity and the numbers became so much that the industry couldn't ignore it. So what happened was the industry, talking the commercial gaming industry, decided they wanted to legalize it, and the other people decided they don't want to do it. So they legalized it in Nevada, New Jersey, and in Delaware. And, it's kind of the game's on, but there's a lot of people who still don't really like it, a lot of those being people in the industry like Sheldon Adelson and Steve Wynn. Guys out of Las Vegas. So it's kind of the same old story. The big guys trying to crush the little guys. So, that's in a nutshell.
Victor, when we talk about online gaming, it is only legal in three states, but why can't tribes, because they have their gaming compacts, just get into online gaming on their own? How is it not just a natural extension to gaming in the brick and mortar casinos?
Well, you know, it's about, that's the big legal debate right now. You know, when you go to an Indian casino, you get in your car and you go to the casino, you go to the reservation, you get out and you gamble. When you're doing online gaming, you're at home and you're sitting in front of your computer and the transaction happens there. So the big debate that's being that's happening around the country right now is where does online gaming happen? The state is saying that it happens where the transaction happens, and the tribes are saying it happens where the bet takes place, which would be on the server, which is on the Indian reservation. So that's the big debate that still needs to be litigated, and that's the big political fight that we're having right now. Is like, you know, is it Indian gaming if it's not on the reservation anymore? So that's the big debate.
Well, we're talking about that big debate today. We are talking about online gaming, and we want to hear from you. Do you want to see your tribe get into gaming on the internet? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Or do you think that it's a bad idea for tribes, particularly yours, to get in on online gaming? Again, 1-800-996-2848. And so, Victor, what are some of the issues with online gaming in terms of tribes building up and starting this?
Well, you know, tribes are looking at this as business people and entrepreneurs. I mean, like I said, you know, they saw what happened to people, you know, companies like Blockbuster Video, you know, which didn't embrace the internet. And you had a small company like Netflix come out of nowhere and totally take the entire industry out from underneath them. So the tribes are very cautious that these type of scenarios happening with them. You know, they've built up these beautiful casinos and become these incredible entrepreneurs and business people. And here comes a new technology getting ready to disrupt their current businesses. I'm of the belief that online gaming, no matter what, is going to happen regardless. It's already happened. If they don't legalize it, you can still go online and gamble illegally. So I think the commercial gaming and a lot of the tribes are looking at it as a way to keep these dollars back in the community, back on the reservation where they belong.
You know, in 2013, former tribal chairman Rob Porter wrote in Indian Country Today, if the online gaming market opens wide, only a handful of providers will control the market. Do we really think that tribal gaming brands can beat out the marquee gaming brands in the global online market? A few larger tribes might, but I seriously doubt, as the research suggests, that tribal casinos will gain new customers in an internet gaming era. Victor, what do you think about that? Is there a possibility that tribes may just get swallowed up by the big fish?
You know, the tribes, most of the tribes are looking at online gaming as a way to support the brick and mortars casino. You know, the model that's being sold and that makes sense to me is that, you know, you use your database. I mean, one of the things that's going to change when online gaming is legalized eventually, at least I think eventually across the United States, is that, you know, one of the things that they show in New Jersey is that the most popular brands in New Jersey are the casinos that have a name in the community. So the people trust Caesars more than they trust Joe Schmo's online gaming casino. So the tribes that have spent all that money and all that work on branding themselves into the local communities, that's who they're going to be reaching out with. I think if a tribe goes out and thinks if they're going to get business, if they're in California, they're going to get business in Maine, I think that's going to be a little far reach. I mean, that opportunity is going to be there. But eventually when online gaming, if it is legalized, you know, the people with the brands are going to do better. But, you know, the future is unwritten. We just don't know. It's a new technology. It's a disruptive technology and anyone can win. But that being said, you know, to get into the game, you have to be very, very well financed. Someone's going to win. Someone's going to win big. It could be the tribes, but I don't think that's a reason not to get into it, because just because you stick your head in the sand doesn't mean things still aren't going to happen.
We're talking about online gaming today. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Do you think your tribe should get into online gaming, or would you rather see them step out of it? Again, 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to a caller. We've got Bradley in Durango, Colorado, listening on KSUT. Bradley, what do you think about online gaming?
I wanted to call and share just the thoughts of the traditional Lakota in regards to gaming in general, including online gaming. I see what's been going on a lot with a lot of Lakota tribes out in South Dakota is that our tribal leaders have been promoting gaming as something that comes from our traditional culture. And yeah, I mean, back in the old days, we did like bet on horse races and there was hand games and things like that, but it wasn't like modern gaming. Today, most of the traditionals are really anti-modern gaming, because it doesn't reflect our traditional culture, because it's very destructive to the family units, because this tool called money that we need to take care of our families and our kids is getting siphoned away to these developing addictions. And so it's hurting our communities, because most of us who gamble at our casinos are tribal members. And then it's also hurting nearby non-reservation families as well. So I just wanted to say that and get that out there. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Bradley, giving us a call from Durango, Colorado, and listening in on KSUT. Victor, what do you think?
You know, he brings up a really good point, which is, you know, out on the Pine Ridge, I don't know if you've been out to Prairie Wind Casino, which is on the far side of the reservation. It's not near Rapid City. So, you know, all their customer base is the reservation. So, you know, you have to be cautious. You have to look at this as business people and entrepreneurs, and you don't want to hurt the community. You know, Indian gaming has brought so much to Indian country in the last 20 years. And so it's important that, you know, we keep on top of it and we make sure it doesn't have the corrosive effect on our family and our community, as the caller said. But again, you know, gaming is here to stay. It's the only thing that's generated the type of revenue. U.S. gaming, commercial gaming is $240 billion. Indian gaming was $28.3 billion in 2013. So in the last 20 years, we went from zero to $28.3 billion. This is, you know, you can't ignore it. You have to understand what it is, but you need to be very aware of the downside of it too. You know, be very, very, very cognizant that there are people out there that can't gamble and have a good time. And, you know, we have to be aware of that. As Native American people, it's very, very, very important.
Online gaming is our topic today. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848, and let us know how you feel about online gaming, whether or not you think your tribe should get involved, or do you think it's a bad idea? 1-800-996-2848. Let's add another voice to the conversation. Joining us from Las Cruces, New Mexico, is Dr. Gavin Clarkson. He is a former computer science professor turned law professor currently at New Mexico State University, and he's a lawyer. Gavin is a member of the Choctaw Nation. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Dr. Clarkson.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Clarkson, I know that you're working with a tribe to start an online gaming venture. Explain to us a little bit about the legal side of things in terms of tribes not just starting up a online casino right off the bat.
Well, Victor gave a pretty good summary of the legal landscape, but there's one thing to keep in mind. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act is not the law that gave the tribes the right to game. Tribes have an inherent sovereign right to engage in activities on their own reservation. So IGRA was not an enabling statute. It was a limiting statute. IGRA goes in and says, we're going to give the states a voice in this process where they previously had no voice at all. Shouldn't have had a voice, but it was just a compromise, and those things happen in the Senate and legislation all the time. But IGRA limits the ability of the state to stop tribal gaming at what is called Class 3 gaming. There's a whole category of gaming that's bingo and games based on bingo and games similar to bingo called Class 2, where there's no requirement for a compact. and there's no revenue sharing from the state. The state has no authority and no ability to regulate Class II gaming on reservation. And so the legal theory is that a tribe could engage in Class II gaming remotely if the game, as Victor pointed out, if the game takes place on the reservation. So there are various different technological and legal mechanisms to ensure that all the gameplay is happening on reservation, and anything that's happening off reservation is merely like, you know, watching TV.
So, Gavin, Dr. Clarkson, let me jump in there for a second. So if you're saying that I'm sitting here in Albuquerque and I'm online on my computer and I go to a tribe in California and play some kind of Class II gaming like bingo, that it still is covered under the compact?
In the continent, Class II is not part of the compact. And it is specifically excluded from the compacting process. Only Class III games are covered by the compact.
So,
the states would like to cover everything. The states, you know, the states view Indian gaming as a revenue source. But it's very clear in both the statute and in practice that the state has no business regulating, taking revenue from, or in being in any way involved with Class II gaming.
Well, but if I'm sitting in Albuquerque, I you know, it's not like some kind of Star Trek thing where I'm transporting myself to the casino in California. I still don't understand how it's covered under you are gambling on tribal land.
Well, so there's an opinion that the current head of the BIA, Kevin Washburn, when he was general counsel of the National Indian Gaming Commission, wrote an opinion basically where somebody wanted to allow somebody to buy a bingo card, but have the tribe play that bingo card on their behalf on reservation and then send them the result back at their home. So for almost a decade and a half now, there has been a legal precedent for what's called remote or agent-based or proxy-based gaming. And so the idea is that you're not actually doing the gaming. You have somebody on the reservation gaming on your behalf. They're the ones that are placing the bet either under your instructions. And it goes back to a centuries-old legal theory of principal-agent, that basically you're the principal, but the agent is on the reservation for you, gambling for you, and then feeding back to you the information about what transpired. So it's basically the historical analog was you sent your buddy up, they bought a bingo card, they played the bingo card for you, and they came back, and you figured out whether or not you won. In the 21st century, imagine that your friend is, you know, you're sitting in your studio in Albuquerque, but you've got a friend with a cell phone up at one of the tribal casinos in the northern part of the state. You know, you're sitting there and you tell them to press the button. They press the button and they say, hey, you won. Monica, you won. And all of a sudden, Ed, so you have, quote unquote, won the game, but you weren't sitting there. You weren't the one pressing the button. You have somebody pressing the button for you.
But how do I guarantee that friend is going to give me the winnings?
Did that gaming take place? Was it there in the studio where you are, or was it where your agent was based on the reservation? And NIGC has said that where the agent was based on the reservation, not where the principal sitting, in your case, sitting in the studio.
Okay, but how do I guarantee that that the person who's the agent for me is going to give me the winnings?
Well, that's the challenge the tribes are going to have. They're going to have to be able to build a trusted system in a way that you are comfortable that somebody, you know, that you have an agent playing on your behalf, and that you're going to get paid, and that you're going to get paid when you win. And but it's the same issue that you would have with any sort of online gaming facility. I mean, if you go, it used to be that you could go to sites in the UK or sites in Costa Rica, you would gamble, but how would you know that you would get your money back? So part of what the tribes are able to do is the tribes are still subject to, they can make themselves subject to certain laws, whether it be tribal laws or contracting principles. You know, you're comfortable right now going to the physical Sandia facility or any of the tribes in New Mexico, and you play, and you win, and you get your money. And so they've already built that level of trust, and so the challenge will be to extend that level of trust into the online space.
This is Native America Calling. You are listening to us today, and we are talking about online gaming. We want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Dr. Clarkson, I understand that what you're working with one of the California tribes has to do with the Turing test, possibly a reverse Turing test. You got to explain this to us.
Well, it's an old computer science principle idea. When you truly get to the level of artificial intelligence, the person who's taking the test should not be able to tell whether they're interacting with a human or a computer on the other end. In some sense, what we want to do is have the gaming server be interacting and not be able to distinguish whether the agent is a human agent or the agent is a software agent. And we have software agents in all sorts of industries. The most common one people think about is in the securities trading business. The days of somebody sitting on the floor at the New York Stock Exchange, while it still happens, the bulk of all trades are done by computer. And you have a computer executing your instructions, and you're bound by those instructions. But ultimately, in the case of when we're doing the online environment, we want to make sure that the play is identical, whether it's an agent that's a human or an agent that's a computer. In either case, the agent is under the direction of a principal, but the game always must happen on the reservation. And so the game server could be, you could actually, the other thing is you could walk up and play it just by yourself. You could actually physically go to the reservation and sit at an iPad or sit at a terminal and play the game. And the game server should not be able to distinguish between somebody who's playing through an agent and somebody who's playing live, because legally it doesn't matter. Somebody who has an agent playing on their behalf on the reservation, from the gaming server standpoint, that agent is just another patron.
Would there be rooms full of empty machines that are reserved for the online person?
Well, you're going to end up having primarily a massive server room, but the implementation that we're working with this particular tribe is they're going to have a small physical facility, but the challenge for most tribes. Victor's numbers of gaming are incredibly impressive, but the bulk of that revenue is generated by less than 20 tribes. And so the tribes that are small or are rural or are out in the hinterlands, gaming is a butts and seats business in the bricks and mortar sense. If there's not a large population nearby, you're not going to be able to generate a whole bunch of revenue. But if you have the ability to reach a large population electronically, electronic commerce is something that can eliminate the geographic disadvantages that many tribes have. And unfortunately, the regulators are trying to squash all sorts of attempts at tribal electronic commerce, be it in the online lending space, be it in the online gaming space. There seems to be this sort of decided bias against.
Right. And we're going to have to go to a break. We'll get to that after the break. You're listening to Native America Calling, 1-800-996-2848. Trevino L. Brings Plenty from the Cheyenne River Sioux Nation will join us on the next Native America Calling. His latest poetry publication, Wakpa Wanagi, Ghost River, is a reflection of his life and the people he's connected to. You're invited to celebrate National Poetry Month with us and our April Book of the Month.
I'm Nathan. My job gave me a lot. It gave me an income to support my family. It gave me purpose and pride. But the secondhand smoke there triggered my severe asthma attacks, infections, and lung damage. And I never smoked. It was so bad that my doctor told me I shouldn't work there anymore. I had to quit my job. But the damage was done. Now I'm so sick, I can't do much of anything I used to love to do. I don't referee youth basketball anymore. I don't run or lift weights. It's too much for my body to take. Instead, I'm taking breathing treatments or oxygen. I guess you could say my job gave me a lot. So let me give you a tip. Don't let people tell you that working around secondhand smoke is safe.
Smoking affects more than just your health. If you or someone you know wants free help to quit smoking, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. Thanks for joining us today. We're glad you decided to tune in. If you'd like to know about the shows that we are cooking up for next week, go to our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. We'd also love to hear your show suggestions. What should we be focusing our attention on? Shoot us an email to comments@NativeAmericaCalling.com. We've been discussing online gambling, which is also sometimes called internet gambling or even iGambling. Should tribes be able to start online gambling operations as extensions of their brick-and-mortar business? And would this bring a bigger opportunity for your community? You can get in on the conversation. We still have time in the hour. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Dr. Gavin Clarkson is with us from New Mexico State University. Dr. Clarkson, before the break, you were talking about the possibilities of tribes in terms of infrastructure being able to actually accomplish online gaming. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, the main thing is that the tribes don't have to have a brick-and-mortar facility to do this. Obviously, the tribes that have the big brick-and-mortar presence, both Victor and I come from tribes with very large gaming operations. And in that situation, the online offerings would be in addition to the brick-and-mortar operation. But for the tribes that don't really have the ability to address a major market, if they're within a state that has a major metropolitan market, they might be able to reach out a couple hundred miles and have patrons from that large city come to their virtual casino online. And it doesn't really take a massive, you don't have to build a big building. What you end up needing to build is a big computer room, and a computer room with obviously connectivity. You mentioned, I think y'all were sponsors with the Tribal Telecom Conference coming up. Connectivity to many reservations is separate apart a big challenge, and particularly for the remote tribes. And so, if the tribe has the ability to get connected with a high speed line, and can put up an air-conditioned server room, they have the infrastructure necessary at that point to offer online gaming anywhere in their state.
We're talking about online gaming. There is still time for you to get in on the conversation. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Let's add one more voice to the conversation. Joining us now is Joe Valandra. He is the CEO of Great Luck LLC, a company that provides online gaming software for tribes. And Joe is a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Joe.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Joe, we've talked about a bunch of different layers to this online gaming discussion, tribes being able to do it, having the infrastructure to be able to do it, whether or not communities think that this is something that's good for their communities. What is at the heart of this discussion on online gaming?
I think it's staying relevant in the marketplace. I think Victor talked about it, as did Gavin, that this is where the world is moving, both not just for gaming, but for, you know, most of our daily lives. I can't say everybody, but speaking for myself, with my iPhone in my hand, I pretty much, you know, make dinner reservations, airline reservations, communicate with my family. That's really what it's about. It's about staying relevant. And more importantly, for tribal gaming, it's about staying competitive. You know, tribal gaming is a very large business, almost $30 billion. Almost half of the gaming revenue that's generated in the U.S. comes in some form or fashion from tribes. And if they don't, if tribal gaming doesn't stay relevant, and that is by getting online, having competitive offerings for gaming, but mainly the focus is on entertainment, that share of the market will diminish, and tribal communities will suffer.
You mentioned, you know, gaming for entertainment, but I know that gambling addiction is definitely a concern of many, and particularly with online gaming, there's an idea that it makes it easier access and could potentially have a greater problem with online gaming. The National Council on Problem Gambling estimates that there's 3 million people who struggle with problem gambling. What do you think, Joe? Is have you considered the possibility that bringing these games online may exacerbate a problem?
Well, I know that's an argument that Mr. Adelson, you know, stands on pretty hard. I disagree with it, and I'll tell you very specifically why. The technology, and actually Dr. Clarkson did a good job of sort of outlining how technology can work. The technology that Great Luck has developed in particular is what I'm most familiar with, does an excellent job, does a better job than bricks and mortar casinos do in monitoring the play and activities of the users that are logged on, for lack of a better term. And by following the protocols that the ABA has adopted in dealing with problem gambling once it's identified, there's a better opportunity, both in terms of monitoring players and the ability to provide information to players, users online, than there is in bricks and mortar. So I think that argument is a canard, in meaning that it's not a real argument. It's a concern, but it's a concern that the whole gaming industry is aware of and is addressing both in bricks and mortars and very effectively online.
Joe, would your software actually just, you know, have some kind of screen that pops up and says, you've been on here too long, you've got to get off?
Well, it's a little more subtle than that. I mean, if you look at the ABA guidelines, or the AGA guidelines, excuse me, noticing activity, someone going back to the cash machine too many times, other characteristics that have been identified by the experts. Just as in a bricks and mortar, the operator has the opportunity to intervene with the player and suggest maybe that they take a break, that they do some other activity that's available online, et cetera. If the player declines, then of course, as every casino, every gaming operation has the opportunity, or the ability to say, "Well, we think you've had enough for today. You're cut off." But it's a subtle thing that can be, and this is true, that by monitoring the exact play of every player, you can have a much more effective intervention, if you will, online than you often do in a bricks and mortar. So it's not just cutting them off, it's actually helping them deal with the problem too.
We've also got Victor Rocha from Pechanga.net, a website that's been around for about 17 years. Victor, we've been talking about a variety of things, but I know that in California, there's definitely some tribes that are trying to get into the online gaming. There's some legislation that's being considered. What is the status with online gaming and tribes in California?
Well, you know, I think it's a good analysis or a good observation of what's going on in the rest of a country. You have tribes one group of tribes that see online gaming as inevitable and they want to get involved in it. And then you have another group of tribes that believe that it should be slowed down a little more. It needs to be observed. And so one group of tribes is trying to drag in their feet, and another group of tribes is trying to go forward with it. But they both really they both have the best intent. They both want what's best for Indian country. You know what I mean? So it's a disagreement. It's at the very fundamental basis about what online gaming is, which is, you know, is it going to affect the bottom line for the casinos? Oh, and by the way, in California, we're talking about iPoker and not iGaming, slot machines, and stuff like that. So it's very important to differentiate between those, because iPoker is considered a game of skill, and that's kind of how it's being sold in California. I believe the inevitability is there. It's just working out the details. So,
what should we be paying attention to in the coming months in terms of online gaming legislation, whether or not it will be completely outlawed for the rest of the country?
Well, actually, I'm glad you brought that question up. I was just looking on my Twitter account while I was Joe was speaking. And, you know, there Sheldon Adelson, who owns the Sands Casino in Las Vegas and last year was in the top 10 of the richest men in the world, has taken a stand that iGaming is bad for the family. It's bad for the this is a guy who owns casinos all over the world and he's talking about it. So it's just a very jaded attempt to stop iGaming and control iGaming. You know, I think what the tribes need to be concerned about is this is just another attempt to stop the tribes at you know, getting a foothold in a new industry. You know, this is really about control. I think when anybody starts talking about iGaming and gambling addiction, I've been in the industry a long time, like 17 years. So I'm a little jaded, especially when it comes from companies like Sands and Steve Wynn and stuff like that. So for me, the big threat is that, you know, companies like Sands want to stop iGaming and they want to make sure that the tribes are not involved in it at all. So to me, it's a direct assault on our sovereignty. And then I think the tribes need to fight it every step of the way. So this is the big thing in Washington, D.C. And the other thing I'd like to point out is that, you know, a good analogy for iGaming and what's going on is if you look at the Class 2 games, you know, when the Class 2 games first came out, look at the technology. The tribe sped up the bingo machine, you know, the bingo game. They sped it up to lightning speed so that now it looks like a slot machine. But at the fundamental basis of it, it's still Class 2 gaming. And so I think the argument for iPoker and where the bet's taking place and stuff like that is an argument of the same caliber, because these are the kind of decisions that are going to affect us later on down the road. So it's very important that the tribes fight it every step of the way, that the tribes have a very flexible understanding of what Class 2 is. And that's really where the argument is right now with iGaming, with the tribes is this Class 2. We don't need licensing. We just sped up the game. It's just online. And so, you know, tribes need to make sure that they have their eye on the ball, that these arguments, that we don't lose them, because the ramifications of a loss are pretty tragic and pretty scary. So the tribes need to be on guard at all times and beware of strangers bearing gifts, you know.
Victor Rocha, thanks so much for joining us today. You can check out his work on pechanga.net. He is following all of these things very closely. And Dr. Gavin Clarkson, is this really, you know, you're saying that politics aside, tribes can just jump in right away. They don't need to wait for state approval. They can assert their sovereign right to this type of gaming. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Well, it's a very circuitous path. There are federal laws that are in play that the tribe needs to be cognizant of. But we believe that there is a narrow legal path where tribes can do this the right way, do it legally, and do it in a way that is compliant with all the relevant regulations and federal laws. But there are certain things that it has to be limited to. It has to be Class 2 based, so it's not impacting any sort of compact, and the state doesn't have the ability to regulate it. And we believe that it has to also be done on an intrastate basis. So we're working with several tribes, but each one will only be offering the access to the system to people within their state. So a California tribe would only be able to have participants from within the boundaries of California. A Texas tribe would only be able to have it from within Texas. Same thing with New York. It would somebody who's physically in New York. And so this is a technology called geofencing, and actually this technology is being used by the New Jersey casinos, which is one of the states where it is legal online. Basically, you have to physically be in New Jersey in order to connect to a New Jersey casino. So it's not instant, it's not easy, but it is doable. There is a legal path, and it requires, it's a combination of law and technology. You have to have all the pieces, and if you don't do every single piece right, unfortunately, there'll be some stumbling blocks. And then there was a tribe in California that unfortunately has already run into some of those stumbling blocks. I think the judge got it wrong because the judge was focusing on a compact, and the compact is completely irrelevant when it comes to a Class 2 operation. But, you know, unfortunately, not everybody can understand all the technological nuances. So that's why it's incredibly important, if a tribe is going to consider this, for them to tread very carefully and move very deliberately and make sure that they're moving on a very narrow legal path.
Thanks, Dr. Clarkson. Thank you so much for joining us today from New Mexico State University. Definitely something we're going to keep an eye on in the future. Joe Valandra, we are wrapping up a little bit early today. Any final thoughts on online gaming?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think Dr. Clarkson was referring to our partners, the Aipei Nation at Santa Isabel, and they are engaged right now in a battle with the state of California, having followed the very narrow path, I guess, that Dr. Clarkson refers to in terms of asserting their sovereignty, their self-regulation, asserting all of the legal precedent that's accumulated regarding Class 2 over the years. It's a fight that needs to be watched. As Victor said, it's something that's a crucial fight for Indian country. We're proud to be part of that fight. I think it's something that everyone should stay focused on, because it centers around tribal sovereignty, self-regulation, and the ability of tribes to have a future online that isn't encumbered by having to deal with states that historically want to hold tribes back. So I think it's if I were to really focus you for a future show, I would have a more comprehensive show about the fight that the Santa Isabel Nation's involved in, and I'd be happy to participate in that.
Thanks, Joe. I did reach out to that tribe and did not hear back from them, so it's definitely something we want to hear about in the future. Thanks so much to our guests, Victor Rocha, Dr. Gavin Clarkson, and Joe Valandra. We're going to end a little bit early today and shift our focus to Hawaii. For years, the University of California has planned to build a 30-meter telescope called the TMT on top of Mauna Kea, the tallest mountain in Hawaii. Construction on the telescope has begun, but recently had been halted due to protests. Joining us now from Hawaii is Kamahana Kealoha. He is the head facilitator of the group Sacred Mauna Kea, and he is native Hawaiian. Welcome, Kamahana.
Aloha kakou. Thank you for having us on your show, and thank you for being concerned about what's happening on our sacred mauna. I just wanted to let you know that our leader on the front line, Lana Kila Manguel, is on the line with us. He was able to join us in this conference call, and he has been leading the resistance spiritually and at the blockade. So I hope that's okay with you folks.
That's fine. The more the merrier. So I'll shoot this out to either one of you. First, let's just start with the basics. Why are you protesting the construction of this telescope?
If you want to go ahead, Lana Kila, please.
Hi. Aloha mai kakou. We're not protesting. We're protecting. This is the land of our ancestors, of our kupuna. This mountain is actually the tallest mountain in the world. It stands over, at its summit, it's at 13,700 feet, but that's above sea level. The base of this mountain goes deep beneath the ocean. And with that understanding and stuff, too, in the ways of our ancestors, this mountain is the pico. It is the center of the umbilical of this planet into the heavens. And so this is where the mana, the energy of the heavens, come into this mauna and is dispersed into this planet. And so it's Akuleana to Malama, this mountain. So we are very strong. This mountain is part of our creation story. This is our genesis. It's connected with this mauna. So for Native Hawaiians and Kanaka Maoli, this is very much a spiritual stand. This is a burial ground as well. This mountain is used for many different things besides, of course, our navigators did observe stars from here as well. But that's to put it into a function that they used, and they did so without being disrespectful and damaging to the mountains. This is a place where the umbilicals of our children are laid, so that they have a connection to this mountain, a connection to the earth throughout our lives. This is a mountain where the bones of our ancestors are laid into this mountain, so that they are close to the heavens.
Kamehameha, talk to us a little bit about the, you know, it sounds like Mauna Kea is a very sacred and important place, and this isn't the first telescope that's being built on this mountain. Talk to us a little bit about where they're at with the construction of this telescope.
Basically, right now, all they've done is brought their machines up. That's what really sparked it. As far as their construction, they say they've already begun construction. They've moved their machines onto the land. That's as far as they got. They tried to do a little bit of work. There was it was over a week ago now, Thursday, where there with the big protest or standoff with police and everybody, where we tried to, well, we only blocked the workers, those who would actually drive the tractors that would damage the mountain. We still left the road open for everybody else who was coming to visit. And, but now that's as far as it got, and they only got past us that day after 31 arrests were made, and our elders advised us to go to rest for that day and not to continue. They were just able to move some tractors around, and that was it. So really, as they might be putting it out there, that they have progressively already started the construction. In a nutshell, they only have their tractors on the property.
Okay. And so the protests, they got a little bit heated. Things have stopped. Construction has stopped. I read that the governor is basically calling for a timeout, that maybe for dialogue with the folks who are building the telescope. What kind of dialogue is going on right now?
Actually, we don't know. The mass, many of us who are here standing in the Mauna and protecting the mountain, our whole nation is rising in support of protecting the mountain. But none of us have been called. So as we kind of hear too, it actually was not the governor who issued a stop, but it was actually University of Hawaii, the leaseholders of the mountain, and the TMT. They put it out there that they are going to stop construction for now. Actually, seemed like quite a ruse for me, because just this past week was our the Mary Mauna Kula Festival here in town, which was literally thousands of Hawaiians and people from around the world came to here, and many people were planning on staying because yesterday, Monday, they were supposed to return for construction. And so last minute on Sunday, they announced that they're not going to do any work for another week. And they say it's back for dialogue, but as they say, and as it's going on in the news, that they are bringing the stakeholders to talk with stakeholders, which is the University of Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, as well as the TMT company itself, and Office of Hawaiian Affairs, OHA, which is supposed to represent the interest in the well-being of the Hawaiian people, but they themselves do not stand in support of quite a large majority of the Hawaiian people on this stand. So no actual talking to the people who are here on the ground. We're not considered stakeholders yet.
I understand that this telescope will bring the view is that the telescope will involve science, you know, and bring new knowledge that maybe is not there in terms of studying outer space and things like that. Are you against the progress of science? Are you against being able to study the universe?
No, not at all. And that is one of the biggest things that especially media afar has been trying to pin on us. Is that, you know, actually, it's like New York Times tried to compare us to being the Vatican supporting Galileo. That is totally, totally not the case here. Many of the people standing here, we have actual scientists. We even have astronomers who support our stand and understanding of this stand is not against science. And technically, it's not even against the building of a 30-meter telescope. It's against their choice of place where they want to put it. That's really our stand, is not here, not on our most sacred mountain, a mountain that over the past few decades has already suffered a lot of damage. That's kind of our stance, I see. Like, our people are very much scientific as well. However, we're very strong in our stance that, you know, there are better ways that you can expand your knowledge and stuff without being so detrimental to your home. And the truth is that many of the people who will come and study in this mountain, this isn't their home. You know, they're from other places and they might move here for a time, but, you know, they don't have the same connection as the people who have been here for generations. And that's what I think is that we just want, you know, in our own ancestral homeland, and our sacred places, and for us, very important, critical mountains to our natural ecosystem and natural resources, we don't want to put that at risk in order to pursue this one form of study of the heavens.
Where can folks learn more about this fight going on?
I'm sorry, with that?
Where can folks learn more? Do you have a website?
Yes, there's a couple of websites. The one I can direct this to that kind of has a lot of information is called kahea.org or kahea.com.
We will put a link to that on our website. Thank you so much for joining us today. Something we'll be tracking in the future. We're back tomorrow with our April Book of the Month. We'll be discussing a book by Trevino Bringsplenty. Our interim executive producer is Tristan Ottone. Tara Gatewood is our host. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Stephen Emmons is our engineer. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support by NativeGiving.org, empowering Native children and families through community giving. The organizations included on NativeGiving.org are developing strength-based solutions to ensure the health and well-being of our most valuable resource, our children.
All the donations made on NativeGiving.org go toward the organization you choose.
Information on how you can partner with successful innovations at NativeGiving.org.
Even if you get care from IHS, you may need to claim an Indian exemption for the 2014 tax year. Use Form 8965 when you file your income taxes. Find Part 3, enter Code E, and check a full year. Questions? Call 1-800-318-2596 or visit www.healthcare.gov/tribal. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.